We in the 9/11 Truth Movement are united in our call for a full independent inquiry into the events of that day. We believe that it is only through impartial evaluation of evidence and cross-examination of witnesses that we can establish the truth. Yet most of the evidence which has emerged now appears to be on our side. The military-grade anthrax cannot be innocently explained away. All the reliable evidence and analysis now indicates that the Twin Towers and Building 7 were brought down by controlled demolition. Similarly, it seems an inescapable conclusion that the Pentagon was hit by a missile fired by the American military, not Al-Qaeda. We can say with similar certainty that Flight 93 was shot down rather than being brought down as its passengers tried to take control of the plane. We therefore call upon the governments and the media of the world to do what we cannot, and that is to alert the citizens of the world to the real threat to their liberty, security, and livelihood, and to ensure that they are protected in future by exposing the perpetrators of this heinous crime. As it is extremely difficult to refute this emerging evidence and analysis, we are entitled to conclude that 9/11 was a false flag operation carried out by Western intelligence, but blamed on Islamic extremists. The current events in the Middle East demonstrate how far 9/11 has been used and abused to justify war on a grand scale and allow the removal of values central to democratic society. By exposing 9/11, we can bring the war on freedom to an end and protect future generations from manipulation by the military-industrial complex. Not to act sends a clear message to the forces of darkness that they can continue to get away with it, that the killing of innocent civilians in false flag operations is acceptable. This will, of course, encourage them to carry out further operations on the back of 9/11 to justify the invasion of Iran or Syria or Lebanon. This makes a further mockery of the truth and democracy. Now is the time to stand up and be counted. Together we can herald in a new age without conflict or exploitation or the slaughter of the innocent by exposing the lie of 9/11. After all, it is not hard. If we cannot expose the perpetrators of this crime with the evidence we have in the society we live in, we do not deserve to live in a democracy. Give me liberty or give me death. Hello there, hi, and welcome to the David Shaler Show on Resonance, or Truth Radio, as we like to call it at the moment. You just heard there, actually, the closing remarks, the conclusion from a film called Short Changed, which I've just made with two brothers called Ollie and Owen Marshall. Really, it's our attempt to try and make some sense of 9/11. We know a lot of films out there, but quite a lot of them are quite long and involved, and we realise that not everybody is going to be anoraks like us and give up 2 hours of their time to watch a documentary. So we've created one that's about 45 minutes long. It's going to be out next week properly. So I'd ask everybody to download it or to get it on DVD and to share it with their friends, basically, because the only way we're going to change the world with 9/11 is by changing the perception of the public, basically. People in Parliament aren't really listening to us, I've got to say. But we've had some breakthroughs in the mainstream press. People are at least mentioning, not doing big articles on, but at least mentioning the fact that there are other theories about 9/11 and 7/7. In fact, the Sunday Times mentioned some of our theories about the Twin Towers being brought down by controlled demolition in its edition last Sunday, basically, and also raised some of the issues about 7/7, including the apparently falsified CCTV image famously taken at Luton Station at 7:21 that morning. And this week I finally got my letter off to Tony Blair, basically. I've been obviously saying I'm going to write to him for some time, and decided now, with obviously the court case over, it's time to write to him and offer him my evidence about how MI6 funded Al-Qaeda, among other things. And I've got a whole lot of things I'd obviously like to talk to him about. And obviously, you know, 9 years ago, his government dismissed me as a junior officer in MI5. He didn't know what he was talking about. But I did point out in this letter, obviously, that I was right about Iraq and he was wrong. And I just really wish that he'd taken that evidence beforehand, before coming to that decision, rather than evolving this belief. Don't quite know how he evolved the belief, but evolved the belief that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, when it was painfully obvious to anybody who'd actually worked in that field that he hadn't had time to develop these weapons, and that any invasion would only increase terrorism, which of course it's done. We've now seen obviously 100,000 dead in Iraq at least, although I've heard a Russian general saying from his professional view 50,000 were killed alone in the assault on Fallujah. Anyway, on to today's programme. Really, something that I think people don't know a lot about at the moment, but I see in a kind of parallel with 9/11. In fact, I talk about this quite a lot on public platforms when I'm doing 9/11, about one of the things that's going to change the world. And that is hemp, or the cannabis sativa plant. It's the same plant as the one that gets you stoned. But what many people don't actually realise is that's perhaps the least useful aspect of the plant. I mean, obviously lying on your bed stoned is not the most productive state to be in, although I would point out that I think this substance can bring you closer to the light. But hemp has many, many uses. And I have with me here Kenyon Gibson, who's the author of Hemp for Victory, History and Qualities of the World's Most Useful Plants. So hello, Kenyon.
Hi, David.
Hi there. So tell us about the book. Why did you come to write it?
Well, I had to write it. It was my sister's passion, hemp. My sister is Myna Haggard. She lives in Santa Monica, California. And we both grew up in California a little bit, though she's stayed there most of her life. She told me the facts about hemp.
And when was this?
Oh, about 7-8 years ago. She told me the basic story. At that time, the leading book was Jack Harris' book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. Jack is also from California. He started on a mission to legalize pot, but expanded his mission, expanded his vision by researching hemp. He went to the Library of Congress at one point looking for a film called Hemp for Victory, which had been made in 1942 after hemp had been prohibited. What happened was the United States realized they needed lots and lots of this stuff for rope for the Navy, for parachute strings, for other purposes. So they got on the ball. They got all their patriotic farmers to grow hemp, mainly in the Midwest, states like Wisconsin and Illinois. They grew lots of it. It was very successful, and then it got shut down. The film, Hemp for Victory, sort of disappeared into the archives. Jack Herer and two of his colleagues went to Washington, look for the film. They were told, oh, it's never been made. You're wasting your time. Get out of here. And Jack just went through all the channels till he found the old library cards that existed that, you know, we don't see in this day and age. This generation maybe doesn't see them as we're all on the net. But those old library cards had that film. And he said, well, here's a library card for it. If you had a library card for it, you must have made the film. And they said, oh, well, yeah, okay. So he found them out, and he found the film. And that...
So what, essentially what you're saying is that the sort of powerful vested interests here are trying to stop us from even finding out that the US government actually made a film promoting hemp, essentially, yeah?
Yeah, that certainly does appear to be the case.
And why is it, do you think, that hemp has been, why was it made, why was it prohibited in 1937 under the Marijuana Tax Act, which obviously made it prohibitively expensive to try and grow cannabis and sell it? Why do you think that happened?
Well, the history of that tax act is that William Randolph Hearst, who owned newspapers, he basically inherited them from his father in the very late 19th century.
Citizen Kane, isn't he?
Yes, the Orson Welles, the classic figure, Xanadu and all that. This Citizen Kane decided that he was going to use fear tactics, and he used his papers to promulgate the myth that black people and Latin people smoked marijuana, which was a word really not in the vocabulary, not in the dictionary then. Few people knew what it was. It was a word that existed in one province of Mexico and has since become a very popular word, but in 1937 nobody knew what this was. They just heard through the Hearst newspapers that black people were going to rape white women if they smoked marijuana, and that 15-year-olds were going to kill their grandparents if they smoked a single joint.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I've seen the posters in the Hard Rock Cafe in London. This is where the kind of Reefer Madness stuff comes from. I've seen these postcards and all these terrible tales in which basically they're comparing cannabis to heroin, really. But what I find really fascinating about this, and I think I'm right in saying this, that actually when the Act was passed, the Marijuana Tax Act, the knowledge of it as marijuana was, nobody knew it as marijuana at all. They knew it as hemp, and it became a shock to them after the Act was passed that this crop they'd been growing for years and years and years was suddenly illegal, or suddenly prohibitively expensive to grow. Is that right?
It was a major shock. It was a shock to industry. The farmers came in and tried to testify. Others who didn't know about it were caught unawares, all of a sudden told they had to get rid of their hemp crop. This was marijuana. What were they doing? And they said, well, you know, this is hemp. This is what George Washington grew. This is what Thomas Jefferson grew. This is what John Quincy Adams wrote about. This is what Abraham Lincoln's wife's family, the Todd family in Kentucky, grew. This is what a number of major American figures grew and just knew was good. The U.S. Navy needed it. The British Navy, in fact, ruled the seas for hundreds of years because of hemp. British monarchs had mandated it for the British people to grow. So along comes this law, and these patriotic American farmers who are growing hemp are now told, you're criminals. The American Medical Association had tried to testify and had been shunted out of the testimony. Certain congressmen had lied about their testimony when the Act was finally passed, and the Act was passed in a very secretive way through the House Ways and Means Committee. So very few people and very few lawmakers on Capitol Hill even knew what was going on.
Yeah, and I'm actually quoted in your book, just kind of giving a quote about hemp. But one of the things I say is obviously there are so many uses of hemp that really 20th century capitalism would not have been possible had hemp not been prohibited. Now, can you tell us a bit more about some of the uses of hemp? You mentioned rope and stuff like this. I mean, obviously, famously, was paper. The original draft, I think it was, of the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp paper. The original Old Glory flag was also made out of hemp. But tell us a bit more about some of the other industrial uses.
Okay, you've mentioned paper. There's the textile use. There's the rope use. There's the edible oil use, which is very high in omega-3, omega-6, and omega-9. Recent studies have shown that omega-3, which forms half of the fatty acid in the human brain, is very good for hyperactive children. They end up taking this, and after 6 months of taking 2 tablespoons a day, they become the leaders in the class. They become very, very focused, and they're able to concentrate.
Can I just stop you there, Ken? You have to mention that usage, because that's just great, because you've actually just led me into a little clip. I got the Big Green Gathering a couple of weeks ago, in which I was interviewing a guy called Free Rob Cannabis, who has been busted several times, but he was just talking along the same lines. So if we could just play that now, that'd be great.
Okay, to make hemp milk, basically the simplest way of doing it is just grinding up hemp seed and putting it into some sort of liquid base. You can use just water, or what I personally use is a vegetable juice base. So what I'm going to use is one of these hand juicers here. It's a simple auger. As I turn it, it crushes it up against a filter sieve here. A pulp comes out the end, and the milk will come out the bottom. What makes the milk, obviously, is the ground up hemp seed, because inside the seed, you see there, that one's beginning to sprout a little bit, and it's all white inside. That's where the nutrient is. So if I just did it with water, it would end up white. But what I'm going to do for extra nutritional benefit is to actually put a bit of powdered hemp leaf with some bit of water, just because otherwise it just floats on the top. So as I'm only going to make a small glass for you here, so I'm going to just whiz that up a little bit. Put some celery through here. A little bit of hemp seed. And celery. And you can put pretty much anything you want for it. Ideally, a big pile of hemp leaf would be good. Or you could put a whole fresh hemp plant through it.
Fresh hemp leaf.
Fresh hemp leaf is best.
Can I have a look at it?
Have a smell it smells divine. I've also got a powdered hemp bud as well. And this is, yeah, this is what I'm basing my super hemp leaf fast upon. Like the guy who ate McDonald's for 30 days.
Yeah.
Well, I drank hemp milk for 30 days last year. felt fantastic, and I'm doing it again, but this time I'm doing it for 40 days. And it's got me to the realisation where hemp is the liberator, you see. It's the most perfect plant as far as nutrition is concerned. It provides us with all the essential nutrients. It provides us with a perfect balance, the essential fatty acids, building block to our cellular system. It provides us with a perfect balance of where it provides us with all the perfect protein, all the what do they call them, amino acids, is 8 essential amino acids. It also is the most, I really prefer it if you didn't smoke right while I'm doing this meal. In fact, if you just hold fire just while I'm doing it. Okay, so yeah, this is almost gonna be ready actually.
So you're putting in about a handful of seeds and
With this one, I've only just started using it today and I don't want to overstress it. But that is gonna be a bit floaty with the hemp leaf on the top there. But yeah, as I'm saying, it's what the mystical element to the hemp is the THC, which this is at like a government approved variety. It's a, like a government approved variety.
It's
of
very
hemp,
good.
Because it's the most healing part of the plant, so it's the part that the government. Those who
that is so refreshing, really is.
Who sell alcohol, tobacco, and other toxic, addictive drugs, they're freely available, but the best part of the plant is the most controlled. And the thing about it, look at it this way, as a plant grows, it's absorbing the etheric photon light energy and converting that energy, the high vibration, down into the physical form of electron-rich chlorophyll, which we find in all plants, which make plants green. So most green plants are incredibly healing for us. But what's unique to the cannabis plant is the THC, well, the cannabinoids, of which tetrahydrocannabinol, more commonly called THC, or abbreviated to THC, that is the most electron-rich molecular plant structure there is. So you feed your body with THC, you're basically feeding your body with light, electron-rich plant structure. Rebuild the body on a cellular level, eliminate the free radical damage until you basically become pure light. You cast no shadow, you come out of the illusion of Babylon, and that's what they don't like, because this is the tree of life. This is the most healing plant on the planet, and this is what this plant has taken me to, where I'm going to be doing 40 days this year on BESS, but my aim for my 40th birthday next year is to do 40 days on water and then to eat from the tree of life. And then I think I'll have fully activated my light body. And rather than getting back on a plane to fly back to him, because I tend to do this up in a place called Tapovan above the source of the Ganges, is to activate my light body, come back and face Babylon. I'm ready for you, Babylon. Because they're all lies. Babylon is based upon lies and controlling through fear. And the fear comes from feeding people with drugs, which put people into a fear addiction system. I've been through the whole system. I've been to court, I've been to prison, I've been all through that. I don't want to go back to prison. This is a prison in many ways, because it's an illusion. This world we're living in has been created through fire. The power of fire has taken the natural elements from the earth and recreated a synthetic world of concrete, of steel, and these machines run on fire, and they're going out and dropping bombs on people to get more oil, to feed more machines, more fire. This, however, is the liberator on a healing level, but also to get us out of that whole dependence upon the petrochemical industry. It provides us with food, as I've mentioned, provides us with a totally natural fiber where we can build things with it, we can make clothes with it, we can make paper with it. We don't need to cut down trees, we don't need to burn fossil fuels. All of it can be done from one plant. It's the most healing plant on the planet. And what the government say? They say it's illegal. It's a lie. The whole government system is a big lie.
Thank you, Rob. That's fantastic. Cheers. Thank you very much for that.
Could you say something about the fast?
Because you already have done some of that, and what that.
So
say something about the nutrition of the plant, a bit more about the balance of minerals and
fiber. Okay, well, it's a perfect balance of the essential fatty acids, the omega 3 and 6 essential fatty acids, also the omega 9. And also, it's the protein within the seed is very high in what's called globular adestine, which is very easy to digest. There's this myth that you need to be eating meat and dairy to get protein. Meat and dairy protein is very coarse and is difficult to digest. Hemp protein is very easy to digest. And then it's also the most vitamin and mineral rich seed source of any plant. You've got the cannabinoids, which are unique to the cannabis plant. You don't find them anywhere else, and they're basically very electron rich. As the plant grows, it's absorbing the etheric photon light energy and transferring it into electron rich chlorophyll, which we find in all plants. But what's unique to this plant, as I say, is the cannabinoids. And you're rebuilding the body on a cellular level, eliminating free radical damage. Free radicals are basically caused by heating, burning, oxidizing things, so the electrons break off and become electron deficient. When you then take that into your body, it steals electrons off other healthy cells, creating tumors which spread through the body as cancer. It was proved way back in the 70s that eating cannabis in its raw natural state eliminates cancer from the body, yet they say there's no cure for cancer. There's plenty of cures for cancer. Cannabis is just one of many natural cures. It's just that the cancer industry is a multi-billion pound industry. My mother died from chemical drugs that she was given to supposedly cure her from the cancer that she had. So it's an incredibly healing plant, which I'm glad to say more people have an awareness of. I'm presently putting out a newsletter, Hemp in Avalon, which is also the name of a hemp store having in Glastonbury, and I'm printing 10,000 copies of this, getting it out to every house in Glastonbury, also to all the local MPs and also Tony Blair and his cronies. And within it, I'll be asking the question of how hempy is your MP? And what I'll be asking them is, do you feel that children should be given the choice between fish oil or hemp seed oil? The plan being that governments wish to give children fish oil as of next September, apparently. From the reports I've heard about, fish oil is not only is it quite rancid, and toxic because of all the chemicals which have been dumped into the sea, but it's also non-sustainable because of overfishing of the sea. Hemp oil is totally nutritious and totally sustainable. And the other question, and to finish off with, is how would you feel about children being taught how to cultivate, harvest and process hemp so that we can create a sustainable future for the world? We've got to get away from this whole thing of the smoking of cannabis. The cannabis which is being smoked at the moment, it's been so messed about with because of prohibition. Thanks to prohibition, it's been taken out of its natural environment of growing in the earth, put into these little rock wall cubes, pumped full of chemical drugs and growth hormones and under artificial light, and then it's been grown and sold by people whose main motivation is how much money to make out of it. The plant is totally stressed out, and because of that, people are having psychotic problems with it. It's not the plant that's to be blamed, it's prohibition. Prohibition has caused so many problems on this planet, and we've got to wake up to this fact that prohibition is the crime. But how, and a plant that grows naturally out of the earth, how can that possibly be a crime? It's totally criminal what's going on. And that's why I'm totally dedicated to raising people's awareness to the healing of this plant. There you go.
Brilliant. Thank you for that, Rob. Fantastic. Well said.
My pleasure. Okay, you ready?
Can you give us your name and the title at the start?
Right, hi, my name's Free Cannabis, and this is a little poem, or poetry, whatever you want to call it. I'll stop. Okay. Go back to... Ready? Hi, my name's Free Cannabis, and this is a little poem that came to me after drinking of the sacred plant, ganja. As I cast the sacred seed upon the earthly mother, I invoke the healing powers of her goddess angels. Shine forth, O angels of power, bringing us the energy of the fire of life. Flow over I and I, O angels of love, for the plant and I are one, and all that is love. Fill our heads with divine knowledge, O angels of wisdom, for as I commune with the fruits of the holy tree of life, so am I filled with the wisdom of the heavenly father and the earthly mother, for we are all of one. For the holy tree of life is the tree of eternal life, and as I commune with thee, so do I commune with the angels of eternal life. For the cannabis plant is perfection in its creation, a perfect balance of essential nutrients to rebuild the temple of God within. O shine forth into every cell of my body, angels of eternal life, so that one day I shall cast no shadow and stand with the full glory of the angels of eternal life. And now that my light body is activated, the work is just begun. So fill me with your power, O angels of work, so that I may spread the word and get the message through. Hemp is our salvation. It really will save the nation and reveal to us God's incredible creation. And now that the tree of life is truly free, so shall the angels of peace reign triumphant upon the earth, heaven upon earth, so shall it be. O angels of peace, I call upon you now, bringing us closer to that state of bliss, bringing us closer to the days of fully liberated cannabis. I give thanks, O Heavenly Father, for guiding me to the tree of life, for as I commune with the tree of life, my communion is with you, O Heavenly Father, for you are the great creator of all that is. And with this plant, O cannabis, I find salvation, a doorway home, a portal for the immortal. I'm coming home. The illusion is breaking down. All is being revealed. Babylon has fallen. The angels rejoiced. And there before Great Spirit on the banks of the river love, rivers of love, groweth the holy tree of life. And the leaves are for the healing of the nations. Thank you, God. Thank God for cannabis.
Okay, that was Free Rob Cannabis, a guy I've met on a number of occasions, has a shop, hemp shop down in Glastonbury. A man obviously in the vanguard of the drug war, but also a man in the vanguard of the hemp war as well. So coming back to the show, I've got Kenyon Gibson with me here today, and Kenyon's obviously just now talking about some of the many varied uses of hemp.
Well, as I was saying before Rob's piece, the edible oil that the hemp seed contains is a very useful product. It's on sale all over the UK, all over the world actually now, mainly in health food shops, but you'll find it in Tesco's and Sainsbury's as well. You'll find the seed, the whole seed in some nut and fruit bars. You'll find that the leaves can be used as well, though I'm not quite sure about the legality of that in the UK, so maybe let's stay off that topic now.
Well, actually, technically, hemp is legal in the UK if it hasn't got the THC in, basically, and that's the kind of natural growing product in this country. We didn't, without the grow lights, we wouldn't have hemp in our THC. And one thing that's always puzzled me, and perhaps you'll be able to answer this, is, you know, because this seed is a great source of protein as well, and when you see pictures of these malnourished people across the world, or even in Western society now, you wonder, why aren't they growing hemp? Because hemp grows everywhere, and is there a reason for that?
Well, there seems to be a lot of prohibition surrounding hemp. In the EU, hemp has been re-legalized since about 1993 across the board, at least in the UK and other countries. I think Germany came on board a little later, maybe 1996. France is now the leading hemp-growing country in the EU. China has always grown hemp. In fact, it's believed that hemp originated in China, and China has never had a problem with it. China has used this for centuries for food. The Russians have used this for food, and I don't believe that there's any problem with this in Russia or the Soviet Union or whatever they call themselves now, the former Soviet republics. They were once the grand mart for this, and about 90% of all the hemp in the world was bought from Russia in around the 18th and 19th centuries.
That was to do with the drying techniques, wasn't it? To do with preparing the hemp, wasn't it?
much to do with that. They had the processing down to a fine art. It was mainly used then for rope, and what they did was they cut the hemp and they redded it. They put it into water tanks, separating the outer fibers, which are long. They're about as thin as human hair, and then they scutched them. They got any bits of remaining lignin, pectin, and other substances off of that till you had basically pure strands of cellulose, which were then woven into ropes. Other countries like to do-ret that by just leaving it in the field, which was a cheaper process, but you got a cheaper product. And the U.S. Navy would not even accept American-grown hemp for that reason, because they wanted the better, finer Russian product.
Right, and just sort of going back to the kind of the legalization of hemp, because I remember reading this famous story, I think it's in your book and in The Emperor's Got No Clothes, about Henry Ford building a car, which its shell was built out of hemp, and also actually ran off biofuel, which came from hemp. So is that, I mean, presumably that's true, is it? Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And that's absolutely simple, too. He made ethanol. Now, we should all know about ethanol. I'm sitting here drinking a little bit of ethanol right now. I think most of us drink ethanol every day.
So I'm partaking a bit of THC. So
I don't think there's any problem producing ethanol. But there was a problem. There was a major problem when Henry Ford said, hey, folks, this is really simple. We're going to be sensible. We're going to be patriotic. We're going to use farm wastes, the stuff that the corn farmers and the wheat farmers and the hemp farmers throw away. We're going to put it in a vat. It's mainly cellulose. It's a simple carbohydrate. No sulfur, no harmful chemicals here. We're going to just ferment it. We're going to have ethanol. We're going to run the cars. Now, you'd think everybody would just say, yeah, okay, Henry Ford, you know what you're doing. This is a good idea, and we can use an American product. But there were people who didn't want really to use American products. There were people in the petrol industry in the 1930s. One of them was Andrew Mellon. He was America's richest man. He was also, for about 12 years, the Secretary of the Treasury. There were a number of scandals associated with him, basically with the fact that he didn't like to pay tax. He ended up investing in General Motors, and so he was able to get the car industry to use petrol and not ethanol. If he'd used ethanol, the world would be, as you said earlier, David, very different today. And Americans wouldn't be spending their money on Arab oil. It's a very ironic concept that Americans are funding the Arab world. Now, a lot of American senators are looking at that and saying, hey, wait a second, we're funding terrorism. And we're spending a lot of money and we're going broke doing it. So why don't you do something? Why don't you make ethanol? Henry Ford did it in 1937. Well, Andrew Mellon may not be around, but there are a lot of people just like him who want to keep on using petrol no matter how many tankers explode in the middle of the sea and kill all the fish and the birds. They just want to keep on using what they're making money at and screw the rest of us.
I actually really think that hemp or cannabis actually takes away all the means of profit of the big corporations that form the New World Order. For example, the oil industry would have its power taken away because hemp is a source of biofuel. In fact, it's a source of oil you can just extract, which has a high calorific value, basically, by itself, which is a very simple process, of course. It's also that the arms industry don't like it because it makes everybody peaceful. The pharmaceuticals industry don't like it because it treats you for just about everything. And I mean, I've used it for flu, colds, muscular pains, everything, basically. And it is a multi-purpose, you know, a panacea for any form of pain or illness or whatever. And I even think that Annie, when she had bacterial meningitis in France, and I gave her a cup of the dope tea, that actually saved her. I think the antibiotic properties of the dope there cleaned her blood out and stopped her from getting septicemia. And of course, the other plank, of course, of the New World Order is the construction industry. But of course, famously, of course, there is now a product called hempcrete. And I've seen this stuff, and it is rock solid stuff that you can build houses out of that's much cheaper, obviously, than processing clay bricks. So we see why hemp is illegal. And and we can see the people who are trying to keep it like that. But despite all of that, we seem to be kind of winning this battle in a sense. We're getting the message out. So, and what are you doing sort of personally to see that the message does get out?
Well, I would love to see that this message gets out, because I would love to see people have their own energy. I would love to see jobs created from this. I hate to hear, when I'm listening to the BBC, about truckers in the United Kingdom who are losing their livelihood because the price of petrol has gone up so much they're not making any profit. I hate to see farmers going broke in the UK. I hate to think about what can happen in the future. It really aggravates me. I'm moved. One thing that I've been doing is contacting people like David Miliband. He is the head of DEFRA, which is that the environment agency that's been sort of changed around over the years. It used to be agriculture, and Margaret Beckett was in charge of it. They've had a number of changes. John Prescott at one time was in charge of it in this present administration. And they don't seem to be doing a lot about hemp. I don't want to say on the radio that they're not. It would be unfair at this time in August of 2006, when many people are on holiday, to say anything really positive or negative without them being here. But I am contacting them. I've given them some time to get in touch with me. I've left messages on David Miliband's blog spot.
And have you sent them copies of the book?
Yes, actually, Jane Taylor of Positive News personally took 3 copies of the book to David Miliband, Peter Ainsworth, and Chris Hune, the Lib Dem environment spokesperson.
Right, I think this whole thing really is a kind of, again, it's like 9/11. It's a symbolic issue, because it should be so obvious to anybody who's looked at the evidence how this can actually change the world and change the way people live. And it's not like this is a choice at the moment. We have to do it because there are problems with oil. Even if the oil's not running out, which I think it is, but even if it's not, there's still problems with, as you say, paying for oil from these barbaric regimes in the Middle East and thereby propping up those regimes. This is the great kind of irony of capitalism. And I hope that we can come round from some of that and basically, as you say, use your book, I'm hoping, to get in front of people as a text that we can convince them we have very, very good evidence for what we're saying. So can you tell us a bit about the kind of preparation of the book and the research and so on for it?
Okay, well, I was saying earlier, my younger sister, Mina Haggard, told me the story and gave me Jack Harris' book. I immediately looked at a bunch of other books to get a balanced opinion. I had a lot of respect for Jack Harris, and one thing that Jack did was he photocopied into his book U.S. government documents, not just the transcript of the film Hemp for Victory itself, but other documents such as the famous Bulletin 404, which was written in 1917 on hemp paper, when the U.S. government found that the waste parts, the inner parts of the hemp plant, which are not as rich in cellulose as the bast fibers from which we make textiles, can be used for paper. So they did a lot of experiments, ran a lot of batches, and found that this was a great idea. He photocopied that and a number of other things into his book. So I wasn't just looking at the opinion of one guy out in California who thinks that it's fun to smoke dope and he can save the world. I was looking at the opinion of U.S. government scientists and U.S. government lawmakers. I had to agree with their opinion. I went to a number of other books and checked all of this through scientific sources, and it was correct. I then, with all this information, thought, hey, you know, there really needs to be a book. My book is a little different than most in that I don't get onto the pot issue. I just personally have never done drugs, so I'm not going to sit here and try to tell people about something I haven't done. I'm going to tell people about something that I have researched that I am into. I've invested in hemp companies. I'm sitting here wearing hemp trousers. I know about hemp. I've been to hemp harvest. I've seen this for years, been part of the industry, and I can speak about it. So that's what I kept my book on the economic and the ecological value of hemp. And one thing I did was, starting in California, I went to the libraries in the University of California system, which is my alma mater, by the way. Then I went to New York, New York Public Library, then to Dublin, Trinity College, then up to Edinburgh, where there are 3 or 4 really great library systems, and then finally here to London, the British Library. I found that there was a great wealth of material, since this had been once the world's most traded commodity. Obviously, there was a lot written on it. Everything that was written on it was positive. A lot that was written on it was written by the government, and it supported people growing it. It forced people to grow it at some point. Jack Harris says in his book that the first U.S. marijuana law was in 1619, when they forced people to grow hemp because they needed it so badly. So here's something that is going to make a difference. Here's something that is going to create industries that can be grown all over the U.K. There's record of this being grown in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and England. And in fact, in every county, I think, in England and Ireland. And places, we need to be doing that again.
Yeah, places like Hampstead and Hemel Hempstead and so on are called that because they used to grow the hemp. That's right, isn't it? Yeah?
Exactly. And one thing, I try not to speculate, but one little point of speculation I did allow into the book was about the town of Cana, where Christ performed his first miracle, turning water into wine. Now, we know that hemp comes from the root cannabis, which is an Arabic, Greek, Latin word. And we look at that word, Cana. Could that not have been their equivalent of Hemptown? And could the fishermen who became his disciples, could they not have been using hemp for their ropes?
Yeah, well, that would make sense, wouldn't it? And in fact, actually, one of the oldest documents in history, isn't it? I think it's a Chinese document, dates from about 2500 BC or something like that, is actually describing the medical uses of hemp, basically. And there are cave paintings of hemp drying out from, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. So clearly it's been with our culture for a long, long time. And I think with this rediscovery, I've got to say my own personal journey on this was actually going to a hemp fair where I bumped into you last year. But what I was amazed by was how they'd booked one of the exhibition halls at Wembley and packed it with people selling various different aspects of the hemp industry. Now, obviously, some of this was grow lights and so on, but a hell of a lot of it was all the other practical uses of hemp. And it's opened my eyes, certainly, because I've always looked at kind of alternative ways of living. And, you know, I'm not really happy with the fact we all pay rent to capitalist landlords, which must be the worst transfer of wealth in history, from, you know, poor people who can't afford their own homes to people who've already got their own capital. And I actually think the way forward is to try and move into more communal living in eco-villages. And hemp is actually what makes that whole kind of eco-living viable, because, you know, with one plant that grows very quickly, you can make building materials, you've got your own oil, you've got your own medicine, you've got your own insulation, you've got your own materials for clothing and so on. So it really is the way forward. If we want to step out of this capitalist society and look at another way of living, then hemp's the way forward. Okay, time for some music. This is The Shaman and Terence McKenna with Re-Evolution.
Human history represents such a radical break with the natural systems of biological organization that preceded it, that it must be the response to a kind of attractor or dwell point that lies ahead in the temporal dimension. Persistently, Western religions have integrated into their theologies the notion of a kind of end of the world. And I think that a lot of psychedelic experimentation sort of confirms this intuition. I mean, it isn't going to happen according to any of the scenarios of Orthodox religion, but the basic intuition that the universe seeks closure in a kind of omega point of transcendence is confirmed. It's almost as though this object in hyperspace, glittering in hyperspace, throws off reflections of itself, which actually ricochet into the past, illuminating this mystic, inspiring that saint or visionary, and that out of these fragmentary glimpses of eternity, we can build a kind of map of not only the past of the universe and the evolutionary ingression into novelty, but a kind of map of the future. This is what shamanism has always been about. A shaman is someone who has been to the end. It's someone who knows how the world really works. And knowing how the world really works means to have risen outside, above, beyond the dimensions of ordinary space-time casuistry, and actually seen the wiring under the board, stepped outside the confines of learned culture and learned and embedded language into the domain of what Wittgenstein called the unspeakable, the transcendental presence of the other, which can be sectioned in various ways to yield systems of knowledge which can be brought back into ordinary social space for the good of the community. So in the context of 90% of human culture, the shaman has been the agent of evolution, because the shaman learns the techniques to go between ordinary reality and the domain of the ideas, this higher dimensional continuum that is somehow parallel to us, available to us, and yet ordinarily occluded by cultural convention out of fear of the mystery, I believe. And what shamans are people who have been able to decondition themselves from the community's instinctual distrust of the mystery and to go into it, to go into this bewildering higher dimension and gain knowledge, recover the jewel lost at the beginning of time, save souls, cure, commune with the ancestors, so forth and so on. A shamanism is not a religion, it's a set of techniques. And the principal technique is the use of psychedelic plants. What psychedelics do is they dissolve boundaries. And in the presence of dissolved boundaries, one cannot continue to close one's eyes to the ruination of the earth, the poisoning of the seas, and the consequences of 2,000 years of unchallenged dominator culture based on monotheism, hatred of nature, suppression of the female, so forth and so on. So what shamans have to do is act as exemplars by making this cosmic journey to the domain of the Gaian ideas and then bringing them back in the form of art to the struggle to save the world.
That was Shaman and Terrace McKenna with Re-Evolution. Okay, so tell us about some of the companies who are starting to sell hemp there, or in its various forms.
Well, we have a number of companies here. About 12 years ago, Bobby Pugh in Brighton started Mother Hemp, then he started the Hemp Shop. Now he started Hempiness, which will be a mail-order company from Brighton. He's actually closing down the Hemp Shop, but he'll be in the same building running Hempiness. Bobby was a pioneer. Bobby knows an awful lot about hemp. In fact, he should have written the hemp book. I got a lot of information from him. He's really done a lot for the UK. He's brought hemp products from around the world. He's supported local hemp projects. As I said, he started Mother Hemp. He got the whole thing rolling. He's sort of the Jack Herer of the UK, though he's not. I wouldn't say he's a hippie. I don't think he's quite into pop the way Jack Herer is. He's a straight-talking guy. He's used to be in the Territorial Army. So once he got things going, once one person got out there and started doing it, a lot of other people started doing it. You've mentioned Free Rob Cannabis. He has his products. There's a guy named Derek Bielby, who is very innovative. Derek is another great source of information.
Sure, I know Derek. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about his machine? Because he's got a patented machine. He's had some real problems kind of trying to keep hold of the patent, hasn't he?
Right. His machine, it seems, was a good idea, and lots of people wanted it. I don't quite know all the back and forth on that.
What did his machine actually do?
I think it was a decorticator.
That's right.
Got the fiber, and I think it was a green decorticator that was able to extract fiber from the stems the same day that it was cut down the field, which would be very economically advantageous. So I don't want to comment on something, as they say, that's sub judice. But
I certainly know from talking to Derek that basically what's happened is a company's kind of stolen his product, and he's been going, and this company for some reason seems to have to support the government, I presume through the hemp licensing system, and they're saying it's not, they're trying to claim it as theirs, and he's just saying, well, look, I had the patent out before they started producing this. This is absolutely crazy.
And of course,
to go back to the legalization, this was one of the reasons, of course, why hemp was actually made illegal, wasn't it? It was the advance in being able to process the hemp.
That's part of it, much part of it. I think big businesses saw that there were a lot of local people that were able to do this because it could be grown anywhere and it would give jobs on a local level. And they thought, we don't want to think on a local level. We want to think on a big control federal level and screw the little guy. And they got away with it for years. So I'm for people like Derek Bielby. As I say, I don't know all the ins and outs. I don't want to pit myself against the other side, because I don't know the other side in the case, and that's sort of a small case, a very small thing really, in a much bigger positive picture. There are a lot of people just doing wonderful things. Jane and Tanya Blonder in Cornwall grew a crop here about 10, 12 years ago. They couldn't quite process the fiber. They sent it to Romania, and then they sent it back here. So they created some fiber, and then Jane Blonder of the House of Hemp in Cornwall sells a hemp silk blend of yarn. That's a very nice little product. But we have a lot of shops opening around the UK. We have a company called the Hemp Trading Company here in West London. We have Pure Sativa, which, despite its mischievous name, really makes a very straightforward and very long-lasting luggage line.
I'm just saying, Kenyon here has actually got a rucksack made by the Sativa company, and I've got to say, it looks a pretty kind of strong rucksack, and not the one you're going to be replacing in the next few years, basically, and looks much more stylish than something in nylon, I think. I think that's the great thing about the hemp fabric, is it's a great fabric to touch, isn't it?
It is. It can be very soft when worked properly, and of course it's strong. We all know that it made ropes, and the Navy wanted hemp ropes, hemp sails. This particular thing, it's a rugged rucksack. It's going to last me a long time. I paid more for it than El Cheapo brand.
How much that cost, just out of interest?
I paid about $35 or so over here at Braintree in the Camden market.
Yeah, okay. So that's not unreasonable. You say it'll last, basically, rather than buying a whole load of these things. But coming back to your point about them kind of screwing the little man with this, the whole thing about the hemp thing, tell us a bit more about what those kind of companies were doing. Companies like DuPont, who actually were instrumental in making hemp practically illegal because of the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act. What sort of other activities were those sort of companies getting up to?
DuPont was basically an arms dealer. They got kicked out of France. Well, they weren't a company then, but the DuPont family got kicked out of France in about 1800. They landed on American soil and sort of ran around the East Coast till they decided to get into the explosives industry, then into the arms industry, and they make money during wars. They make about a 600% increase in their profits during wars. And in World War II, or before and during World War II, they were caught colluding with the Nazis. There's this incredible collusion that...
Okay, so I think we all know about the funding of the Nazis or the investment in the Nazis by companies like Coca-Cola and IBM and so on prior to the Second World War. But the interesting development is you're saying they were actually doing this during the war when America was involved. That's right, isn't it?
Well, let me be a little careful here. There were a number of arms companies, some of whom went so far as to make arms for Hitler on American soil, and then have that shipped clandestinely to Hitler. U.S. government record indicates strongly that Prescott Bush was involved in abetting the Nazis.
This is the grandfather of our current George W.
And that was in 1942, after America had declared war on the Axis powers.
And so DuPont were involved in this as well, yeah?
DuPont made arms that went to Hitler, but it is possible that they stopped at a certain point. However, there were many secretive agreements. One such agreement said, an agreement like this can't be put into writing because it's illegal. And so they were busted.
How do we know that if it's not written down?
Well, let me read the exact text here. Government evidence in a 1945 trial included a letter from a Mr. Haas of Philadelphia to a Dr. Rohm of Darmstadt, Germany, written in 1936, which included the following statement. A matter like this cannot be put into the contract because it would be against the law. We have to rely on our verbal assurance, and our experience with DuPont during the last 15 years has proven that they can be relied upon to live up to an arrangement of this kind. So I don't want to say full on that DuPont was making arms for Hitler at a certain time. I would say read the book. I'm just being a little legally astute on the radio.
But there's been evidence released under the Freedom of Information Act, doesn't I understand as well?
Yes, a lot of that information is in Charles Higham's book, Trading with the Enemy. Charles Higham is a very good writer. He didn't get into this because he's a conspiracy theorist. His focus was entertainment. I think he's written a lot of biographies of major Hollywood stars. When he got to Errol Flynn, he found a lot of dodgy material, and it seemed to him that Errol Flynn was basically a Nazi agent. He pulled information out using the Freedom of Information Act in the 70s and 80s, and then he just saw this whole body of evidence showing that American arms companies were making arms for Hitler during World War II, and that they were shipping it clandestinely using firms like the Hamburg America Shipping Line, in which Prescott Bush had a part, to Hitler. And that's why the war went on for so long. You have to ask yourself, why does one country with a little support from Italy and, you know, the Japanese thousands of miles away, how can this one country fight the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth largest and say 12 other countries for so long? They were getting secret weapons from America.
So the conclusion that would be, obviously the Second World War went on a lot longer than it should have done. Of course, it wouldn't have been possible to put any of the kind of final solution into position if that war hadn't been sustained in that way. And it is really quite astounding, isn't it, that this sort of stuff is coming out, but we don't know about it. We're not getting it in our mainstream press all the time. But that's in some ways not astounding when we think the people who own the media these days are the same people who own the defence contracts. So they're not going to stand up and say, we don't want any more war. They make money out of war through the propaganda they actually put out in the media. Anyway, our show's coming to an end now. I'd just like to say thanks very much, Kenyon. That was absolutely fantastic. Very interesting stuff. Thank you. And I would say to people, please go out and buy Kenyon's book, Hemp for Victory. Where's it available?
Well, it's available right now at Foyles, at Houseman's. You can order it through Waterstones. And it's available at hemp shops. www.thehempshop.co.uk will have it. I might like to mention, finally, it has a foreword by actor Woody Harrelson, who is a very genuine environmental activist. He's done a lot for the movement, and I just like to say on the air, thanks to Woody for coming on board and helping me with this book, and to everyone else who's been involved as well, and to you, David, you've helped me with it along the way too.
Well, thank you. Tell us a little bit just about Woody Harrelson next. He has written the foreword. How did he come to write that?
Well, my sister knows his wife. They live out in California, and his wife comes into my sister's shop. But that's not actually how it finally happened. I met Bobby Pugh earlier this year, who I said was the father of the modern hemp industry in the UK. And I showed him the book, and he looked at me with this intense light in his eyes and said, "Guess who came into my shop last night?" And I said, "Tony Blair, George Bush." He said, "Woody Harrelson, man." And the dude was cool, and he took me out to dinner, and we had this great talk. And I said, "Oh well, you know, I've been wondering if maybe Woody would like to write a copy for an introduction for the book." And Bobby was on it, and Bobby hooked up with Woody, and Woody got a copy of the book, read the book, emailed me, and said he'd like to do an introduction, and that was just great. So we slowed the production of the book down a little bit. We were in the final stage then, but obviously anybody with any sense would wait for Woody to give us his input, and I'm glad that it's in the book.
Great. Well, thanks so much for that, Kenyon. It's great. Thanks. And as I say, by the time this goes out, I'm actually recording this, strange enough, in my bedroom, would you believe? And by the time this goes out, I will hopefully be sitting naked in a hot tub in Totnes, expanding my consciousness. So have a good weekend, everybody, and cheers.
Marijuana plant is a hemp plant, and it's used for many other things than just smoking. And they grow. hemp.